You know, one thing I'll just say before we get started on the next presentation, it's at the IDSA meeting, the Infectious Disease Society of America, last year, there were probably somewhere between a dozen and two dozen presentations on the impact of rotavirus vaccination on various measures, hospitalizations, outpatient visits, emergency department visits, and so forth in various parts of North America. And the results were remarkably consistent that there was a huge drop coincident with the introduction of rotavirus vaccines. Now we've been a little bit, or we were a little bit reluctant last year to declare victory and go home. And part of the reason for that is that there's been some mathematical modeling that suggested that we would expect to see that large decline the first year, and that the second year of the program we might see a little bit of a rebound. Now I'm not sure if that's exactly what's going on this year, but that's certainly one explanation for it. That same modeling would suggest that if we continue what we're doing, which is to say that immunization coverage continues to increase in young children, that we should see the numbers go down again, probably next year or the year after that. So moving on to the next presentation, the use of immunization information systems in vaccine effectiveness studies. As many of you know, immunization information systems, previously known as vaccine registries, are slowly coming of age in public health. And I think the data really in the last few years have been extremely useful for a number of things. And this is one instance where they've really been able to use this information quite effectively. And in fact, the focus of Layla's talk is going to be on using immunization information systems to look at vaccine effectiveness. Layla Sani is from Texas Children's Hospital and is the Immunization Action Plan Coordinator there. So.
Thank you for the introduction. The research that I'm about to present today was part of a larger study, a collaboration between the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention and Texas Children's Hospital. And before I get started, I'd like to acknowledge my colleagues who helped with this research. The objectives of our study were to validate immunization information obtained from an IIS against parent and provider records, with the provider record typically being recognized as the gold standard, and assessing the utility of an IIS in evaluating post-licensure vaccine effectiveness. As many of you know, IISs are comprehensive repositories of immunization data for children and adults residing within a specific geographic region, and that can be city-based registries or state-based registries. IISs have traditionally been used in assisting with medical decision-making through the use of forecasting algorithms, have been used to conduct reminder recall, and are also used to determine immunization coverage levels and identify pockets of need within an area. In 2007, 71% of children less than 6 years of age had two or more immunizations recorded in an IIS. Before I get started, I'd like to just review the history of IISs in vaccine effectiveness studies. There are three published studies that we found that used an immunization registry in some way, shape, or form in VE studies. The first was reported by Averhoff in 2001, and assessed hepatitis A vaccine coverage using an immunization registry. This was a study that looked at the impact of hepatitis A vaccination among high-risk outbreak areas, and doses of vaccine were administered and recorded in a public health department immunization registry. The data was used to calculate vaccine coverage, and although immunization and vaccine effectiveness were calculated, registry data were not used to do that. The second study tracked demographic information of study participants using TWICIS, the Texas-wide Integrated Client Encounter System, which is a public health EMR. Influenza vaccine was administered, and the effectiveness of inactivated and live influenza vaccine were looked at. The authors also used the registry to calculate vaccine coverage, but again, did not use the registry data to look at vaccine effectiveness. And the last study was reported in 2008 and actually looked at the Boston IIS and its potential for calculating vaccine effectiveness using registry data. The authors looked at DTaP, MMR, and hepatitis B vaccine coverage and examined the agreement between provider and registry records. They found that there was substantial agreement between the two records, but that several of their participants were missing immunization registry records, which limited the ability to use the registry to do this. This was part of a larger study that assessed post-licensure effectiveness of pentavalent rotavirus vaccine, which I will refer to as RV5, during February through June of 2008 in Houston at Texas Children's Hospital. We conducted active rotavirus disease surveillance and approached all children 15 days through 23 years of age who had symptoms of diarrhea or vomiting. Diarrhea was defined as the occurrence of three or more loose stools in a 24-hour period. Vomiting was one or more episode. Parents or guardians were approached, assessed for eligibility, and then enrolled and consent was obtained. A parent-guardian survey was administered, and this assessed patient demographics, disease symptoms, duration, and the severity of illness. And fecal specimens were obtained when available and tested using an EIA for rotavirus. As part of the enrollment, we did request immunization records from the parent or guardian. We obtained parent records in about 20% of cases. We also requested immunization information from providers. When we enrolled parents and patients, we asked for up to three providers who had immunized their children. We then contacted those providers and requested immunization records. We also looked in the local immunization registry, HHCIR, for immunization records for enrolled participants. Participants with no immunization information available from any source were excluded from analysis, and all doses of vaccine were entered into a study database and double-checked for accuracy. When analyzing data, we looked at doses of DTaP, pneumococcal conjugate vaccine, and pentavalent rotavirus vaccine obtained from all sources. We selected DTaP vaccine because it's widely administered. It's a good marker for the primary series. And then we also looked at pneumococcal conjugate vaccine because currently it's the only childhood vaccine that is available singly and not in some combination with other vaccines. We then calculated Kappa statistics to examine the agreement between information obtained from the different data sources. This diagram just shows you where and how we obtained immunization records. You can see that for about 88% of participants, we obtained a provider record from the provider identified at enrollment. Parent records were obtained in about a fifth of patients, and we obtained registry records for 284 out of the 628 participants. And you can see that 58 of the 628 enrollees had a parent registry and provider record available. And then 48 patients had no record from any source. This table shows the distribution of DTaP and pneumococcal conjugate vaccine by record. You can see the parent record on the left, the provider, then the registry record, and then the combined record. That's the most complete record incorporating all three different sources. And you can see that both the DTaP and PCV7 vaccine distribution agrees quite well. 7% of our patients had no doses of vaccine. And just to remind you, we did enroll patients who were as young as 15 days of age. So in some cases, no doses of vaccine was appropriate. About 15 or 16% of patients had one dose of either DTaP or PCV7. 14% had two doses, and 64% had three or more doses. Looking at RV5 data, you can see that almost half of our participants had no doses of vaccine. And again, while that's appropriate in some cases, this large percentage probably represents non-administration of vaccine. It's not reflective of the age range of our participants. 16% had one dose, 12% had two doses, and a quarter had three or more doses. And I believe in almost all cases that was three doses. I don't think anybody had more than three doses administered. Comparing RV5 and PCV7 data, looking at the combined record, you can see that almost half of our participants had no doses of RV5, compared to 7% who had no doses of PCV7. Good similarity between 1 and 2 doses, and then a big difference in the number of patients who had 3 or more doses, with 25% having 3 doses of RV5 and 64% having 3 or more of the pneumococcal vaccine. The next few slides look at the agreement between records obtained from each source. You can see that about 122 of our participants had parent and provider records available, and between 88 and 91% of the time those records agreed. Between 8 and 9% of the time the parent record had more doses than the provider record, and in between 1 and 3% of the time the provider record had more doses than the parent record. So you can see there's pretty good similarity between parent and provider records. This next slide looks at the parent record as compared to the registry record. 61% of our participants had a parent and registry record available, and you can see that in 84% of records, RV5 data was the same. This is slightly higher than for DTaP or PCV7, and in between 15 and 25% of the time, the parent record had more doses than the registry record. And finally, looking at the registry record, very rarely did the registry record have more doses of either vaccine than the parent record. Comparing the provider and registry record, you can see that we actually obtained both records for a large number of our participants, and in between 70 and 78% of the time, those records agreed, with RV5 data agreeing slightly more of the time than either DTaP or PCV7. For between 16 and 24% of the time, the provider record had more doses of either vaccine than the registry record, and between 5 and 6% of the time, the registry record had more doses than the provider record. This last slide looks at patients who had all three record sources available, the parent, the provider, and the registry. You can see that 78% of the time, all three records agreed for RV5 data. And then between 67 and 69% of the time, the records agreed for DTaP and PCV7 information. The biggest differences were seen if you look at the parent record. 16% of the time, the parent record had more doses than the registry record for RV5 data, and then between 24 and 26% of the time, the parent record had more information than the registry record for DTaP and PCV7. And finally, the provider record had more information than the registry for 16% of RV5 doses as compared to 21 to 24% of the DTaP or PCV7. Looking at this, the first thing I asked was, why is there more agreement among rotavirus information than there is for either DTaP or PCV7 information? And I think this is probably due to the fact that almost half of our patients had no doses of rotavirus vaccine. So there's much more likely to be agreement when there's a blank space or no information on a shot record than when there is a date that may be a day or two off or the year may have been written incorrectly. So I think the large difference is probably attributable to that. And finally, we calculated Kappa statistics to look at how well the records agreed. And just to review Kappa statistics, a value of 0 or less indicates no agreement between data sources. Then as the Kappa statistic increases, the agreement between the records increases. So 0 to 0.19 indicates poor agreement. Fair agreement is 0.2 to 0.39. Moderate agreement occurs when the Kappa statistic is at 0.4 to 0.59. Substantial agreement at 0.6 to 0.79, and then almost perfect agreement when the Kappa is between 0.8 and 1.0. So looking at this table shows the agreement between the three data sources for vaccine and then the three sources of record. Looking at the parent and registry record, we had 265 patients who had both a provider and a registry record available. The Kappa statistic indicated that there was substantial agreement between these two data sources. And then compared to PCV7 and DTaP information, that Kappa is a little bit lower, but still indicated moderate agreement between the sources. For the parent and registry record, we found a substantial agreement between those two sources. For PCV7 and DTaP information, we could not calculate a Kappa statistic. Kappa statistics depend on there being similar sources of information for each value. There were no parent or provider, There were no parent or registry records with no doses of PCV7 or DTaP information, so we could not calculate a Kappa statistic for that. And then finally, looking at the provider and the parent record, there was almost perfect agreement for RV5 data and substantial agreement for PCV7 and DTaP data. And again, I think the increased agreement between rotavirus information is because of the large percentage of records with no rotavirus vaccine administered. This table shows the availability of immunization data. As you can see, there are really no differences between our rotavirus positive cases that had parent, provider, or registry records available. As part of the study, we also enrolled acute respiratory infection control patients to calculate vaccine effectiveness, and also used patients who tested rotavirus negative for controls. And there was really no difference seen between the availability of records for those sources. The one thing I'd like to point out is that a registry record was only available between 42 and 49% of the time for patients. So that's an important consideration when contemplating if registry records should be used for vaccine effectiveness studies. We did calculate vaccine effectiveness as part of the study. You can see that three-dose vaccine effectiveness, when calculated compared to rotavirus negative controls, was 89%. It was 85% when acute respiratory infection control patients were used, and 82% when registry data were used. So those VE estimates are all very similar. In conclusion, when participant IIS data were available, they were very similar to data available in the parent and provider record. Vaccine effectiveness calculated using IIS data was also similar to that calculated using parent and provider data. And due to the variability in quality and completeness of IIS data, before conducting a vaccine effectiveness study relying solely on IIS data, a validation and comparison of records should be conducted. And finally, population-based immunization information systems may represent an excellent source of immunization data that can be used to conduct VE studies. Any questions?
I was wondering if you could explain perhaps if there was a stratified analysis maybe to be done in the future that would look at the influence of number of providers, or if all the providers who had reported data were also participants in the registry. I wanted to put in I'm Diana Bartlett from the CDC, and I wanted to put in a plug for CDC grantees who receive immunization grant money to apply this fall for the 2010 funding for the NIS IIS match project. It costs about $15,000 to $20,000, and the NIS children that are sampled are then their names are sent to the state registry or city registry, who are the grantee, and their records are compared with each other. So it's a very similar analysis to what you have done here, and it's going to be offered not only for children, but children 19 and 35 months of age, but also for adolescents as well, the NIS teen data. So registries who would like to get a sort of a data quality pulse check on their adolescents can do that with the NIS teen comparison. But one of the things that one type of data that you have available that they don't in this analysis that I'm talking about has is that you have access to know which of your providers who are participating in the study are registry participants or not, mm-hmm. which is something that the NIS project doesn't have access to. So it enables you to do interventions to contact or figure out if the difference is not just because participating providers may not be submitting data, or you could have providers who just aren't participating at all in the registry. So those could be two contributors to the numbers that you're reporting here.
Absolutely. And we found in about half of the participants that we enrolled, their data were in the registry. When they were in the registry, they tended to agree with the provider record. We had some patients who had been to multiple providers and had registry information only for one of those providers. And if they had moved and gone to a new provider, only the older part or the newer part of their immunization record was in the registry.
So. I'm sorry, my question is actually for the first speaker and for the moderator, going back to the studies in New York. And I was wondering if you could just explain the rebound that you mentioned about maybe a slight increase in rotavirus cases in this new season, and that about how that was expected or why that would be expected, and if you happen to know if there were certain strains or types that were more prevalent during that time. And then if there were any considerations given to indirect costs associated with rotavirus cases or hospitalizations, such as parents taking time off from work to be with the kids in the hospital or anything in that nature.
I guess to answer the first question, the mathematical modelers who model infectious diseases, typically when they have created models of interventions such as vaccination, you oftentimes will see a rebound at some point in the immunization program. It just has to do with the fact that you see it when you haven't immunized everybody, and so that you start to get some older children who are susceptible, and that population grows up to a point where there's enough susceptible kids out there to cause another outbreak. But we actually saw that sort of phenomenon when they first introduced polio immunization. We also saw it a couple of times after measles immunization. The most recent was the resurgence in 1990. In this case, what the model that I was talking about had shown was that because you were only vaccinating half or fewer of the kids less than one, you started to get an accumulation of kids older than one who were still susceptible to rotavirus, and that's why you would get a rebound the following year. But that tends to go away as immunization coverage increases. And then the second question I know had to do with indirect costs, but I wasn't sure exactly what you were getting at. They only looked, you know, in the New York study, they only looked at the cost of hospitalization in the hospitalization database that they have. I had one other question for Layla. I know you're continuing to do surveillance for rotavirus at Texas Children's, and with a new vaccine coming online now, Rotarix, are you going to be able to look at the vaccine effectiveness separately for the two vaccines?
Part of one of our objectives for this season's rotavirus vaccine effectiveness study was to look at the effect of mixed receipt or independent receipt of either monovalent or pentavalent rotavirus vaccine. Currently, we are not really seeing very widespread uptake of monovalent vaccine in Houston, so I'm not sure how well we'll be able to do that, but that was one of our goals.
All right. Well, thanks. Thank you very much.